Thank you.
Hey, family. My name is Jeremy, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Jeremy.
My sobriety date is November 13th, 2010, which means next week I'll have 9 months. Seems like my brain wants to say that's a very short amount of time, but I can't even begin to tell you how it seems like a lifetime ago. Things are just a lot different. I was actually thinking on the way up, the hour and a half, 2 hour drive up here is a beautiful drive, and we rode up with the radio off, came up with Dan and Perry. And just how peaceful it was, you know. And even though I'm a little nervous, and how just 9 months ago I couldn't manage a 2-minute walk down the street without going into a panic attack, just being absolutely terrified. So it's been a big change in that amount of time for me. I am sponsored. I'm extremely grateful and blessed to have a wonderful sponsor in Richmond, and to be part of a sponsorship family that's extremely active, very centered in the middle of the circle and the triangle. They're big primary purpose people. They do a lot of service, and they help a lot of people, and there's a lot of fellowship. Just a week ago, we got together and had a pool party, and it was a good time. That's been very important in my sobriety. My home group in Richmond is the Bonnier Big Book Study Group. We meet on Wednesday nights at 8 p.m. And we go through the Big Book. First week of the month, we read a story from the back of the Big Book and then discuss it. And then the middle weeks in the month, we read from the first 164 pages. And the last week of the month, we do a tradition and a concept. And I have a service position in that home group. All those things have kept me busy. I've what I call AA immersion since I got sober, and it's done wonderful things for me. Let's see here. What I was like, what happened, and what it's like now. I grew up in Smithfield, Virginia. It's a tiny little town, ham capital. Down in Hampton Roads. My childhood was the best way I can describe it is just utter chaos. I grew up with an alcoholic addict mother who remarried when I was too young to remember, right after my twin brother and I were born. So I had a stepfather who was physically abusive to my mother until she left when I was 8 years old, and I haven't heard from her since. She's just sort of disappeared, and we were left with our stepfather, who then became physically abusive towards me. You know, I was a fearful kid. I had anxiety. I mean, as far back as I can remember, I used to bite my nails when I was like 4 years old, to the point where they would bleed. They used to wrap my hands up in socks and tape just so I couldn't get at them. I was just a lot of fear. I was scared of people, and absolutely terrified of my stepfather, just never knowing when he may go into a rage. I did a lot of I read a lot as a kid. That was one of my ways of escape. I always loved to get into a book. I liked adventures and sci-fi, things like that. I really identified with a lot of the stories where, you know, kind of rags to riches, or people that just, characters that came from difficult situations, and then, you know, that was sort of the start of the book, and then they go on these great adventures and become heroes, and wonderful things start to happen in their lives. And I always just kind of thought, you know, maybe I was born into this crazy life just so that maybe something big's on the horizon. Maybe some, you know, this is just setting me up for something big. I always sort of dreamed and daydreamed about something outside of the craziness of my life. I stayed in that household until I was 13. At that time, my stepfather attacked me for the last time. which resulted in me being blinded in my left eye. I'm actually blind in my left eye. And I was taken away from that home and put into foster care. I spent the next year in and out of the hospital going through several major surgeries to repair my eye. Unsuccessful. It was just too much damage, too much scar tissue to really have anything to do with that. Sort of bounced around in the foster care system. Went through two different homes before I ended up in a wonderful home. Just amazing people took me in. Some of the most loving and kind people I've ever known. And this is kind of like a part of my life. I was 14 when I, you know, starting to go back. I, you know, missed my freshman year of high school. I was homeschooled while I was in and out of the hospital. And this was sort of like, all right, you know, like I'm finally out of this situation. Life's starting to happen, you know. Things were starting to get good. And I made a very conscious decision at that time that I wasn't going to, you know, that I was going to be somebody, I was going to try to get out of my shell, I was going to work really hard, I was going to try really hard, you know, take all that time that I spent reading books and just being the quiet, shy kid and observing people and try to put that to use, and just try to, you know, do good things. You know, I got really active in a church youth group. I was very active at school. I was a straight-A student, involved in a few clubs. I ran cross-country for a year. I started working in a local pharmacy there in Smithville when I was 14. And I always felt like it was a big effort, and I had to try really, really hard to fit in and talk to people. And I was kind of like a chameleon at school. I would kind of wander around from group to group to group and was kind of friends with everybody. Things were going well. It worked. It took a lot of energy out of me. But it worked to a certain degree. My life was going pretty well. I got a scholarship to go to VCU in Richmond. I moved to Richmond in 2000 when I was 18. And up until this point, I'd never drank or done any drugs. You know, growing up in the atmosphere I had and knowing the history with my mother, you know, an interesting fact about my stepfather is he never drank. He never touched a drop of alcohol, to my knowledge. I think he was just a sick man. But I knew that about my mother, and I knew I just knew I didn't want to have anything to do with that. I just was really trying to do this goody-goody path type of deal. And my first year of college went pretty well. You know, I made A's and B's. But things were starting, you know, a lot of the anxiety and fear that I had as a kid that I managed to work really hard on sort of pushing down in me during my high school years started to resurface. I didn't have too many friends. I moved up there with a roommate of mine, and we ended up parting ways. Things just didn't, you know, we kind of had a falling out, and I went into my sophomore year of college just feeling alone. And at some point in time around that time, I started to drink. And I don't remember my very first drink. I think I dabbled a little bit. You know, I don't really drink. Okay, I'll have, you know, like one beer or something for a short time. But I do remember the first time I got drunk. I went to a party somewhere in the Fan near VCU. And I just had a blast. I remember getting to that buzz point and just instantly all the stuff that I had to put so much energy into doing, to talking to people and to, you know, trying to fit in, I didn't even have to think about it anymore. It was kind of like the alcohol was the fuel for that. And I just had a great time. I remember kind of walking home from that party. Actually, that night there was a meteor shower coming through, and I remember it was like 4 o'clock in the morning. We were walking home and some folks were up on a roof building. And they were like, come on up, watch the meteor shower. So we were laying on this roof, passing around a bottle of Jack Daniels, watching this meteor shower. And for lack of a better term, that night is very sharp in my memory. It was It was just a beautiful thing. I felt like I was on top of the world. I felt like I was just finally, that wall that had always been between me, I was, you know, I felt at ease. It didn't take me long at all for that to become the norm for me. That by the second semester of my sophomore year, I was drinking Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sundays. I'd stopped going to a lot of classes. I really wasn't sleeping much. I stayed up late, and morning classes were out of the question. And by the end of that semester of my sophomore year, I decided to take a semester off. throughout that period, my foster parents, who I'd grown up with, I think they were noticing some changes going on with me. And they were real concerned. They'd come up and visit and call me all the time. And it just got to be too much for me. That was kind of the first part of my life where I started pushing people away. I eventually just cut off contact with them. I was under the impression that, you know, no matter what's always happened, I've always gotten through it on my own. I've always been independent. I'm on my own now. I can take care of myself. I don't owe these people anything. And so I sort of cut them out of my life. I started working in restaurants at that time. Put my phone out here so I can keep an eye on my time. And I loved that atmosphere. It was awesome. I mean, at this point in time, I was just having a blast. We worked hard and we played hard. At that first restaurant I worked at, I was cooking, I was waiting tables, and we'd go to work, make a pocket full of cash, and afterwards we'd go out to the bars until they shut down at 2 o'clock. And then we go to somebody's house and drink till 5-6 o'clock in the morning, sleep till 2 or 3 in the afternoon, go to work and do it over again. And that was the daily thing. I mean, I did that for the next 10 years, really. I worked in several different restaurants, and we drank a lot. I used to have so much fun. I mean, I hung out with people who worked hard and played hard like I did. And we'd do all sorts of things. And everything we did, we always were drinking. You know, we'd go camping, we'd go hiking, and we'd go to the beach. And we'd go dancing, and we'd go to karaoke bars. Just had a lot of fun. That went on, you know, for... So that was when I was about 19, 20 years old. And we were going out to bars. I had no problem getting into bars. I didn't have a fake ID. I didn't need one. We know I work in the restaurant industry. We need the places to go where there'd be no problem getting served. And so probably... and that, you know, that was the norm for me. And I didn't think there was anything odd about it. Everybody I worked with, everybody I hung out with did the same thing. I've never been fired from a job. I'm a runner. When things start getting, when the heat starts coming on, I can kind of sense it coming, and I'm like, all right, you know what? I hate this place. You know what? This new manager is riding me too hard. I'm not making enough money. I'm going to find somewhere better. And, you know, I always knew somebody else in another restaurant. I always got another job. Never had any problem with that. Around the time I was 25, 26, I was working in a little cafe there in Richmond, and I was the opening assistant manager, so I'd be there at 6 o'clock every morning and open up. Around that time is when I started having morning drinks. I'd get there at 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning, just all by myself, and a little orange juice and champagne, a little mimosa, just to take the edge off, so I could finish the rest of the shift. That was a great job for drinking, let me tell you, because in my first hour or 2 hours by myself, when I could have a mimosa or two, you know, work, it was a real chill kind of like bookshop kind of coffee shop cafe atmosphere. Again, I worked with people that did the same thing, And I'd be off by 3 o'clock in the afternoon, which left plenty of time to get wasted and get in bed before I'd have to be up the next morning. It was around that time that, kind of in the back of my head, there was something that was sort of whispering to me that was just kind of like, you know, you might have a problem. You know, you might be drinking too much. You might want to slow down on this. And, I stopped going to bars a lot during that time. That's when I started going home and drinking a lot. I was like, I'm going to get on this, I'm going to start cooking at home, and I'd get off work, and I'd go to the grocery store, and I'd buy all these groceries and go home and grab a, you know, I'd get a bottle or two of wine and go home and just hang out in my kitchen drinking and cooking. I figured that would keep me out of trouble. It really didn't change anything other than where I was doing it. Quite honestly, I was saving a little bit of money by not going out to the bars. My problem in the bars is once I get on a good buzz, I start buying other people drinks. I never really had a problem with that. I never had a problem with running out of money because I would just, you know, go to work the next day and make another pocket full of cash. Left that job. Truth be told, at that time I was helping myself to their wine and beer supply, and also to the petty cash box. Perks of being a manager. I was having those morning drinks, and I was starting my performance was starting to show it, and started getting the little talks and things like that, and I was like, all right, it's time to get out of here, you know. So I left. I actually moved into a catering position, which was a wonderful job. I ended up actually becoming the general manager of a catering company down in Richmond, and I loved it. It was a fun job. It was kind of like all the fun parts of restaurants without all the hardships. I was making wonderful money. I had a company car and a company phone. My business was paying half my rent. I actually lived in an apartment above where our business was. We worked hard, and we'd get off at the end of the day, and we'd all go out and have drinks. And, at this point, any thoughts that I ever had of having any kind of problems or troubles with my drinking were completely gone. You know, all the any kind of money troubles I'd ever had. I had this really cool loft apartment. You know, I was pretty much told myself, I was like, you know, I know I drink a lot, but I'm not an alcoholic. I don't have a problem. You know, I've got a great job. I'm making tons of money. I've got a great apartment. I've got tons of friends, you know. There's nothing really going on there. You know, my life's great. One morning I had an appointment. It was a Saturday morning. I had a 9 o'clock appointment with a bride, actually. I was, doing some menu planning with her for her wedding. And, after that meeting, my boss sat me down, because, you know, he had sat down in the meeting. He's the owner of the company, and he's very involved. He sat me down and he said, Jeremy, you were drunk during that meeting. And I was like, no, I wasn't. There's no way. Maybe from the night before, maybe I did a sort of tie one on last night. And he was like, you were stumbling, you were slurring. He's like, you know, that's just, you know, that can't happen again. And you know, I was like, okay, you know, that won't ever happen again. And this is, left that meeting. That was on a Saturday. The next day I did my normal Sunday routine. Sundays were my normal day off. I loved days off because that meant that I could drink during the day without guilt. I love drinking during the day. It's my favorite thing to do, is wake up. Some Sundays I would set my alarm and get up early. It's a true story. Because I loved the idea of getting up and guilt-free drinking, you know. I would get up, and my normal Sunday routine is I'd go across the street to the little diner there, I'd have a cup or two of coffee and a Bloody Mary or two, read the paper, and then I would go next door to my bar. You know, it was kind of like my bar. That's the bar I went to every day. You know, where everybody knows your name. Then I'd switch over to Budweiser and shots of Rumble Mints. And that lasted normally until 2 or 3 in the afternoon, and I'd go home and take a nap. And by that, I'd pass out on my apartment floor. And that particular day, I woke up from my nap. And pulled the empty bottle out from behind me. I was laying on top of on my apartment floor. And I sort of came to, and for some reason, I just had a moment of clarity. And I was like, holy, my boss was right. I was like, oh man, he is right. I was drunk during that meeting. And, you know, even when he had talked to me and he told me that, for some reason, I guess it's delusion, I didn't even realize, you know, I couldn't tell the truth from the false. Because I was absolutely convinced that I wasn't drunk during that meeting, but for some reason I woke up from being passed out on my apartment floor that afternoon, and I was like, he was right. You know, I didn't even think about the fact that that morning, Saturday, I knew I had a 9 o'clock appointment, and I'd gotten up at around 5 o'clock in the morning, went downstairs to the restaurant, and made myself a giant quart-sized vodka and orange juice, because I knew that going into that 9 o'clock meeting, I would be shaking if I didn't have that drink. And it didn't even cross my mind when he was telling me that I was drunk during that meeting that I had just done that, you know. And so, you know, one of those things that I felt was true was, you know, I have this great job, and here that was in danger. That was one of the consequences I saw, and that sort of opened me up to the truth of what was really going on with everything else in my life. My job was in danger. I was drinking on the job all the time. That awesome apartment, and it was a cool apartment, was filled with empty bottles. I had empty liquor bottles, wine bottles, and beer bottles everywhere. You know, I'd clear away a little space on the floor so I could pass out. Because it was a loft apartment, and it was normally too scary for me to climb up in my loft when I was drunk. I'd fallen before, so I'd normally sleep downstairs in my lazy boy or on the floor, just wherever I happened to fall. I didn't eat much when I was drinking. I'd order food and get it to go. Subconsciously, I guess. I don't ever remember consciously thinking about this. I guess I wanted people to think I was eating. So I'd order food in front of them and take it home, and I'd stick it in the fridge. And when the fridge got full, I started stacking up next to the fridge. So I had, you know, rotting leftover food all over the place. And I was looking around my apartment, and I'd never let anybody in my apartment ever. And I was like, ooh, this is the great apartment I'm living in. And I was like, you know, I don't have any money problems. But the truth of the situation was, is when I ran out of money, which was pretty quick, even though I was making really good money, I would steal money from the business. And just sort of help myself to that. Or I'd go down and steal liquor. The only real friends I had were the ones that were drinking with me in the bars. And I kind of had this moment where I was just like, you know what, I'm about to, you know, I'm in trouble here. I've got to do something about this. And I made the decision that I was going to quit drinking. I went to my boss the next day. I was like, you know, I told him, I was like, well, you know, what you said really struck home for me. And I realized that, you know, drink has sort of taken too big a piece of my life. And then I'm going to stop. He called a friend of his who's in the program, actually took me to my first AA meeting. I remember leaving that meeting, and I was shaking, and I was a mess. I remember leaving that meeting and thinking, man, that's a wonderful group of people. Like, some of the nicest people I'd ever met in my life. And I was just like, man, I'm really glad they have such an awesome program for those people that need it. Because I was just absolutely convinced that, I was going to quit drinking, and I could do it on willpower alone. You know, I knew it was going to be tough. I knew I was having withdrawal symptoms. I'd done my research online. I went and saw a doctor, prescribed me Anabuse, you know, the drug that makes you sick if you drink, and some phenobarbital for a week to help me through the withdrawal, which I, took the way it was prescribed to me. I'd tried drugs in the past, but They scared me. I didn't like the way they made me feel. And they didn't get me there, that magic place like alcohol did. So I just never really gave drugs too much consideration. And, you know, the fact that he was prescribing me, I didn't think anything of it. I just was going to get through that. I went to meetings during that time for about maybe once or twice a week. I didn't really want to have anything to do with steps or sponsors or anything like that. I was really pretty much just going to appease my boss, to let him know that I was kind of doing the deal. I guess it was probably about after 2 months, I just stopped even going to those few meetings that I was going to, and I stopped taking the interviews. About a week after I stopped taking the interviews and going to meetings, I was working a catering event, a wedding, and we were walking around, and you know, they did the champagne toast, and we were walking around and clearing away all the champagne flutes. This used to be one of my favorite parts of weddings, because people always would do these champagne toasts, and it's amazing to me how people don't drink all their champagne. But I loved it. It was my favorite part, because, you know, I'd get a tray full of half-full champagne flutes and go in the back, and, you know, some of my employees would be dumping them out and putting them in the dish rack. I'd be dumping them in and putting them in dish rack. Now, I hadn't been drinking for a little over 2 months at this point, but I didn't even think about it. Thought never even crossed. I didn't go, that champagne looks good or anything. I walked in the back, took it off, tossed it back. Thought never even crossed my mind. I had no mental defense. It was there, and I was going to, you know, it was just muscle memory, and it was going down. That night after we got back from, and it, you know, I went and smoked a cigarette shortly after that. I was standing back there, and I was like, oh, man, I just drank. And I was like, oh, well, you know, I haven't drank in 2 or 3 months, and things are well, you know. I don't think it's a big deal. That night I went back to the restaurant and made myself a big Jack and Coke. And within the week, I was right back to where I was before. I was drinking in the morning, getting off work and going home, and drinking. That lasted for about a month before my boss sat me down again. He said, "You're drinking again." I said, "No, I'm not." And he sort of gave me that look, and he was like, "Jeremy." I was like, "Okay." I was like, "You're right, I am." And, you know, that time I was like, all right, you know, it's time to get serious with this. So I started going to an intensive outpatient program. And I went back to the same doctor who prescribed me the antabuse. And he's like, "Well, do you want to get on the antabuse again?" I said, "No, no, no." I was like, "I'll just stop taking it again." I was like, "There's got to be something better." And they gave me a naltrexone implant. This is a drug they actually developed for heroin addicts, but they found it helps reduce cravings for alcoholics, and they implant it in you, and it slowly releases this drug, which helps reduce cravings. I was like, "Yeah, give me that." I had these implants. I was going to an intensive outpatient program, which required me to go to 3 meetings of AA a week. Also required me to get a sponsor. And during that time, I got a sponsor, and I got pretty active in AA, in at least the fellowship side of things. You know, I got a home group. I even had a service position in that home group, a lot of young people in that home group. And I was busy going to meetings on a regular basis. And I went through the IOP program for 3 months, and I had these naltrexone implants, which... you know, it's hard to say, but I think they did help reduce my cravings. Things were really good. I stayed sober for close to 9 months that time. Towards the end there, I'd been through the last bout of my naltrexone implants, and I started to just sort of back away from AA, you know, just meeting here, meeting there. You know, I can handle just going to 3 a week, and then 1 a week, and then none a week. And then I went through my Facebook and started deleting all my AA friends, and stopped returning my sponsor's calls, and I'd gotten to the point where I was sober and things were going well, my job was going well, and life seemed like it was better, so I didn't really need that anymore. You know, it's a great program. I'm glad it's there for those people that need it, but I didn't need it anymore. And that was last year, somewhere around January 2010. Somewhere around March, April, I figured it would be okay to smoke a little marijuana with my friends. And on Cinco de Mayo, I decided I was going to go out and have a beer. Just one beer. And, you know, at this point, I'd been pretty thoroughly convinced that I had a problem with alcohol and that I was an alcoholic. I kind of knew that going out and having that beer probably wasn't going to turn out well. But in my mind, what I said was, you know what? I can go out and have a beer or two that night, maybe for a few days, and when things start getting bad again, because, you know, I was pretty convinced they were, I'll just head back to AA. I was like, I'm just going to take a little break, a little mini vacation. And then I'll go back and I'll get sober again. I'll get sober. Is what I'm going to do. And I'm sure you guys aren't surprised to hear that's not the way it worked out. Within 2 weeks of that, of Cinco de Mayo, I was getting off work, drinking anywhere from 2 to 4 bottles of wine by myself in my apartment, or a fifth of liquor when I could manage to get the courage to get in my vehicle and drive to the liquor store after work. By the time I got off work in the afternoon, the shakes and the anxiety was so bad that I was too scared to get in the car and drive to the liquor store, so I'd walk down the 2-minute walk down the streets to the convenience store, which was absolutely terrifying. I'd be looking over my shoulder the entire time. I was absolutely sure somebody was going to find, you know, catch me doing it. You know, I'd walk into this convenience store every single day. You know, they knew who I was, and they tried to be friendly and try to talk with me, and I'm like, just hurry up, you know, like. Within a month of all this, I'm absolutely miserable. I have to drink in the mornings now because the shakes are so bad. I'm leaving. I'm, you know, going into work late when I do go into work. I'm leaving work early because I can only take so long without drinking before I have to do something about it. Luckily, I lived in the same building where I worked, so sometimes I would go up and take a quick shot or two. To make it through the day, and this period of my life was just absolute terror. You know, when I wasn't working, I was holed up in my apartment, and you know, just hearing noises out in the hallway, I'd, you know, be peeking out the peephole. I was, you know, I don't know what I was so scared of, but I was just absolutely terrified. And I got to the point where I didn't want to be drinking. You know, there were times where I'd get off work in the afternoon and I'd make it to my apartment without getting anything to drink, and I would pace back and forth around my apartment. I'd try to sit down and read, and I'd read the same sentence over and over again. I'd turn on the TV and just couldn't focus on anything, and the whole time going through this mantra in my head, I'm not going to drink, I'm not going to drink, I'm not going to drink. And that normally lasted about 20 or 30 minutes before I would have to. I'd find myself walking down the sidewalk to get something to drink. Sometimes I'd go and get just a 40, you know, I was just a 40, you know, just stop this feeling. I'd go home and drink that 40, and then I'd go back out and get another, and that happened a lot. Waking up in the morning, Big Book describes it the best, the hideous four horsemen of terror, bewilderment, frustration, and despair were upon me. Those mornings, I just couldn't imagine leaving my apartment. Anxiety attacks and overwhelming feelings of despair took over. And I got to the point in early November where I just couldn't imagine going on like that. By this point, I was having some pretty nasty physical symptoms. I was having blood when I went to the bathroom. Number twosies. I was throwing up, blood. I couldn't eat. I was having trouble sleeping. And I was sitting in my apartment this one night drinking, and, I didn't want to be. You know, and I'm absolutely convinced at this point that I'm dying. That this is killing me and there's nothing I can do about it, and that it's taken way too long. I can't imagine going on like this for a few more days, let alone a few more weeks or a few more months, however long it was going to take for me to actually die from drinking alcohol. And I got an electrical cord and climbed up in the loft of my apartment and tied it around the railing and put the other end around my neck, and I stood there and I was just like, you know, I can't take this anymore. I stood there for a long time. I didn't have the courage to do anything, do it. Looking back, I don't think I really wanted to die. I just didn't know what else to do. I didn't know how to live. And I didn't have the courage to kill myself. And I stood there for a long time crying, with this electric cord around my neck, and I just couldn't seem to do it. And I told myself, all right, I'm gonna go to bed. And if I manage to wake up in the morning, because I wasn't so sure I would. I never knew if I was going to wake up. I was that convinced I was dying. Then I'm going to call somebody for help. And when I woke up the next morning, I called my sponsor from before. She and her husband took me to Chippingham Medical Hospital there in Richmond. I spent 24 hours in ICU. And another 3 days in the hospital from GI complications and from pretty severe withdrawal symptoms. While I was laying in the hospital there, it was on the third day, it was a Wednesday. I was laying there, and by this point, you know, the doctors had come and told me, they're like, you know, you're through the worst of it. You're going to be okay. And for some reason that, you know, that's not really what I wanted to hear. You know, I was absolutely overwhelmed with this blackness. I couldn't see. I hadn't been drinking then 3 days. I was laying in the hospital, and doctors told me I was going to be okay. And I couldn't imagine going back out in the world and living sober. And I was laying in that hospital bed, and I was just like, you know what? When I get out of here, I'm gonna have to take care of this. I can't imagine anything else. There was nothing else left in me. All my ideas had run out, and I was absolutely hopeless. I can't even explain it. My sponsor came to visit me in the hospital that night, and I remember the conversation's really kind of hazy. I don't remember everything that was said, but, you know, I remember I was angry and sad, and I was crying, and I was upset, and I couldn't, you know, the idea of a higher power, the idea of God, being a benevolent and loving God, just at that point in time pissed me off. I was like, you know, I couldn't imagine that I would be born into the abusive household that I'd been in, that the rest of my life that I'd been made an alcoholic, that everything was going like this. And I don't really know how the conversation sort of got here, but it got to the point where I looked up at my sponsor. She had this look in her eyes. It was a look of pain. She was hurting for me. She was really scared to see me where I was in this darkness. But there was also a lot of love. And she asked me if I would be willing to believe that she believed. Would I be willing to believe that it worked for her? And she lent me just the tiniest little bit of hope. Just the flimsiest of reed of hope that allowed me to say, yeah, I'm willing to believe that you believe. And it says in Bill's story in the Big Book, all it takes to make a start is just a willingness to believe. Not to believe, but a willingness to believe. And she left that night, and I laid in that bed, and it wasn't there were no real words to it, but there was a kind of silent prayer in my head. Looking back, I know that's what it was. I don't think I really planned on it being a prayer, but it was like, I don't know what to do, and I give up, you know, I don't know what to do, and it was like something cracked inside of me, and I just had this overwhelming feeling of calmness and peace, and the sense that everything was going to be all right. 2 days later, I got out of the hospital. My sponsor husband picked me up, actually, and with an hour of picking me up from the hospital, we were on our way down to Virginia Beach. They took me with them to the Pockets of Enthusiasm conference that they have down there, which is exactly where I needed to be. My experience ever since, ever since I made that decision just to give up, and you know, ever since I was willing to believe, that's kind of where things started. I don't know really that it was a conscious decision. I don't know that I was capable of that, but something happened that was not me. And that conference was it was just wonderful. I mean, I really wasn't sleeping. You know, here I'm a week sober out of the hospital and still pretty rough. I wasn't sleeping, and I was up at 5 o'clock in the morning, sitting out on the beach, watching the sun come up over the ocean. And I just said that again. You know, it was just I truly believe my higher power said, you know, started with that little bit of willingness and said, all right, we're going to kind of bombard this, you know, we're going to hold on to this while we can. And I just, again, had this overwhelming feeling that it was going to be okay, that there's a life worth living. I felt like I was in the sunlight of the Spirit. There's the scales of pride and prejudice fell away, that the prejudices and the old ideas I had against the thought of a higher power are completely gone. I can tell you that. I know in my heart that there's something bigger at work here, and I've had the opportunity since I've been sober to see that happen. I truly believe my higher power put a whole lot of people around me from day one who live the principles of this program in everything they do, who were examples for me and showed me what to do. Not just told me, but showed me, and allowed me to get through those first rough few weeks, and got busy. And hey, I was, you know, at this point I had stopped working that job. I had the opportunity to go back to that job, but it was going from being general manager to just being a care and grunt. Kind of reminds me of the story in the Big Book, the guy with the car dealership, who went back as a car salesman and built a resentment and ended up drinking again. But it was just too tough for me to go back there. And I'd spent a lot of time praying about it and talking with my sponsor and decided that it wasn't right for me. My boss there is a wonderful man. You know, he gave me a lot of opportunities, helped me a lot in this journey. He introduced me to the person that brought me to my first AA meeting. And I believe that he was placed in my life to lead me here as well. He laid me off. It's kind of like under the rug laying me off, so I was able to get unemployment. So for several months, I really just sort of immersed myself in AA. I was going to 2 meetings a day, at least. My sponsor's husband runs some recovery, AA-based recovery houses down in Richmond. They recommended it would probably not be a good idea for me to go back to that apartment all by myself, which there was no argument for me. Whatever you guys think is best, sign me up. And I went there, and that was an amazing experience too. You know, at the start, it was just great to be around people. And then towards the end, after I was there for a little over 7 months, what I really found was a great opportunity to be of service to new people that came in. A lot of people coming in from out of town rehabs and treatment facilities, and, you know, taking them to meetings. And introduce them to folks. It was a real opportunity of service. Got a home group. Got a service position in that home group. and started working the steps. Probably my first month sober. Let's see, it was a little over 30 days, maybe around 35, 40 days. I went on a 12-step call with my sponsor. Went and picked up a guy. Ended up taking him to the hospital, and I'm not completely sure because when I was first admitted, I was a little hazy, but if it wasn't the same room, it was pretty close to the same room that I had been laying in the emergency room recently, and I was sitting on the chair on the outside with this guy. It was a pretty powerful experience to see, even in just that short amount of time, how far I'd come. On my six-month anniversary, my sponsor, I'd gotten cleared to take meetings into Tucker's, which is a detox program in Richmond. I spent 2 days in that detox after my 3 days in the hospital. So on my six-month anniversary, we celebrated by taking a meeting in there. Since then, I've taken several meetings in there, and this was a really powerful experience that night to be able to say, 6 months ago I was right here. I'm really excited that, I think next week I'm doing orientation to go into the Goochland Women's Correctional Facility. I'm going to start taking a meeting in there once a week. I'm also really excited that I just got my first sponsee. Started working with a guy last week. That's really cool. All these opportunities of service have really helped me out. There have been times in sobriety where I've been depressed, where I've had some anxiety, where it's just been kind of overwhelming. I remember it was around Thanksgiving, and I was 2-3 weeks sober, and I was going home from a meeting, and I was just irritable, and I was going to this recovery house that I just moved into, and people were just really annoying me, and I was depressed, and I was just like, this is not so great. And I called my sponsor, and she told me, she said, well, you know, what do you expect? You're 2 weeks sober, you just moved into a new house, you're dealing with people. And you're allowed to feel that way. That's okay. But it doesn't matter what you think or how you feel. It's what you do. You can walk through that. There have been times where I woke up in the morning and I didn't want to get out of bed. And there actually were a few days where I didn't. I laid in bed all day. And let me tell you, just laying there, it didn't make me feel any better. My sponsor's been really big about the fact that, the best we get here is human. And everybody has rough times, and everybody is sad sometimes, and everybody has problems. And it doesn't matter how I'm feeling. If I'm feeling sad or if I don't want to be around people, it's what I do. And that means getting off my butt, putting one foot in front of the other, and showing up. And I truly believe that I'm alive today because a member of Alcoholics Anonymous is busy in Alcoholics Anonymous and practices our primary purpose, that she and other people like her make themselves available. That's the way it's been taught to me, is that, when I go to meetings, it's number one to make myself available to hearing something and to improving my spiritual connection with my higher power. I hear that from you guys. When I hear your stories and hear your problems and how you're dealing with them, your experiences, that's one of the biggest ways my higher power talks to me, and it helps me to kind of right-size things in my life. My sponsor is very big on that too. But the real reason I go is to make myself available to helping people, and because my sponsor did that, because she made herself available to help an alcoholic, I'm alive today. And that's what I try to do now. I've been taught that when somebody picks up a white chip, or there's a newcomer in a meeting, or even a visitor from out of town, that we go out of our way to reach out our hand to them and try to make them feel at home. You just never know when that's going to, that might save somebody else's life. And, a whole new world's come into view. I truly believe that the compulsion to drink has been lifted from me. I feel like I have what I need, and that everything's going to be okay. that that there's a whole lot more in store for me as long as I focus on the maintenance of my spiritual condition. I'm going to try to help others. You know, I had to try a lot of different things, but being on the other side of surrender and just letting go has been the start of my life, really. This is the first time, you know, as a kid, and I always dreamed that, you know, things were going to be crappy and there's something bigger in store. It's here. You know, I've got a real purpose now, and I really thank you all for having me. It's a real honor. And I'll pass. Thank you.